Hello, and welcome to the CISC podcast. In each edition of this series, you'll have the chance to meet a CISC staff member or other educational professional involved with the CISC community. We think you will find these podcasts of great value as a variety of people share their unique insights in their respective fields. Now, please enjoy this edition of the podcast as our host, Bob Kretzmer, speaks with our guest.
Daniel Baer of the law offices of Pollock, Vita, and Baer has been a longtime business partner of CISC Property and Liability Division. His encyclopedic knowledge of the government code makes him a unique and valuable asset to the CISC program. He is a 1990 graduate of the University of California Hastings College of Law and was admitted to legal practice that same year. He focuses his attention on representing clients with appellate and constitutional law issues. Daniel has the distinction of being recognized by his peers as a super lawyer. I recently had an opportunity to have a discussion via Skype with Daniel, who is located in Los Angeles, California. We discussed the government code, and in particular, the areas of the code focusing on the filing of government claims. I think you will benefit from listening to this edition of the CISC podcast. Daniel, thank you for being with us today here at CISC. It's a privilege to get a chance to tap into your expertise on the government code, and I think this information is going to be of a great benefit to our membership. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for the honor.
Daniel, why do public entities have to receive government claims in order for individuals or other entities to recover damages?
That is the result of a process that stretched out over decades. For most of the 20th century, there were an array of laws, both statutes and ordinances, that governed how people could sue public agencies and the process. And there were different laws for different agencies. It was pretty much a confusion. Then in 1961, there was a California Supreme Court decision called Muscoff versus Corning Hospital District, which addressed the question of whether public entities were generally immune from lawsuit, except to the extent that they allowed themselves to be sued. And they said, no, they're not. Said they can be sued like anybody else. The legislature responded to that by passing what is now known as the Government Claims Act. It was previously called the California Government Tort Claims Act. And that was passed in 1963 and went into effect in 1965. And it included a claim provision. There had been previous claim provisions in these individual statutes that governed individual agencies. This laid down a single claim provision that applied to most public entities in California. There are a few exceptions. We don't have to worry about those, because the important thing here is school districts are among the entities that are covered by the Government Claims Act. The goal of the Government Claims Act is, before a public entity gets sued, they may want to have a chance to investigate the claim and decide whether they want to settle the case without litigation being filed, which theoretically would save everybody a lot of time and money. So the goals of the Government Claims Act's claim presentation requirement, according to DeCamp-Lemons versus County of Santa Clara, a California Supreme Court decision, are to provide the entities with sufficient information to investigate and appropriately resolve claims before litigation, and also to plan for potential liabilities when working out budgets.
Great. Thank you for that explanation. So where in the government code are the key provisions found that lay out the rules for the filing of a government claim?
You're going to look at the 900 series of statutes in the government code to see the statutes that govern claim presentation. The first one is Government Code Section 901, which talks about the rule of when the time to present a claim starts running, the date of accrual. which is usually the same date that would apply if the plaintiff were suing a private defendant. You start the time to present a claim running from then. Then you go to Government Code Section 911.2, which sets forth the time periods for presenting claims. And for personal injury, personal property, that sort of claim, it's 6 months from the date of accrual. For other claims, such as claims for damage to real property or for non-payment of money, breach of contract, etc., it's 1 year. Then you go over to Government Code Section 910, which sets forth the mandatory contents of a claim, what a claim has to set forth. And we'll talk about that in a little bit, probably. And Government Code Section 910.2, which requires a signature by the person who's presenting the claim or somebody who's presenting the claim on that person's behalf. And then finally, you look to Government Code Section 910.6, which allows people who present claims to amend those claims. Generally, the period for amending a claim is either before the public entity has acted on the claim or within the original time to present the claim, which is the 6 months or 1 year that we talked about.
So does a claim for damages or a government claim, does it have to be filed on a printed claim form provided by the school district or the public entity?
The answer is no. There are some public entities that have to provide claim forms, such as the state of California or a court that's being sued. And even if they provide the claim forms, a person doesn't need to use them. It's optional for other public entities, such as a school district, to print up a claim form, and that makes it a little easier for somebody who's presenting a claim, but there's no requirement that the person use a claim form, as long as they put in all the mandatory elements in Government Code Section 910 and 910.2, it's perfectly good as a claim. Even if they leave something out or they don't quite meet one of the requirements, it can substantially comply with the claim requirements and has to be treated as a claim. Even if it leaves out crucial elements, but it's a document that puts the recipient on notice that the person is making a claim for damages, and that if it's not satisfied, a lawsuit will be filed. That's enough to make it a claim as presented, and it's something that the public entity has to respond to as if it were a claim, or else risk waiving defenses.
So at CISC, we'll receive claim forms from our district, and we always want to look at, are the key elements contained in that claim? And so, what are the key elements that need to be in that claim form or other document that is sent into CISC?
Well, again, you want to look to see, first of all, does this document ask for money or something like an accident or an injury or a breach of contract? And does it put you on notice that if you don't pay the money, they're going to sue? That is the bare minimum. The actual contents that are required under Government Code Section 910 are the name and post office address, not just the email address, post office address of the claimant, the post office address to which a person presenting the claim wants notices to be sent. Again, post office address, not email address, not fax number. This is important. The date, place, and other circumstances of the occurrence or transaction that gives rise to the claim. That is the meat of the claim. That is where the claim tells you what they're making a claim about. A general description of the injury, indebtedness, obligation, damage, or loss incurred so far as known at the time the claim is presented. In other words, you can't just say, this happened. You got to say, this injured me in some way, and explain what the injury is, generally. If you know of the employees who caused the loss or damage, you have to provide that. If not, then generally you have to provide, you can provide that you don't know which employees are involved yet. If you're claiming less than $10,000, You have to set forth the amount that you're claiming and how you calculate it. If it's more than $10,000, you don't have to put in the amount. You do have to say that whether or not this would be brought in a limited civil court, what they used to call municipal court. Now it's a limited civil case. And under Government Code Section 910.2, it has to be signed by a claimant or somebody on the claimant's behalf. Now that last part is important because a claim can be presented by the person who's making the claim. It can be presented by an attorney on that person's behalf or anybody else. Anybody can present a claim on behalf of anybody. And that person may not even be authorized by the claimant. There are situations where a claimant is in a coma and an attorney takes it upon herself to present a claim on that person's behalf. And the person wakes up and says, I don't want that attorney to present a claim on my behalf. I want to present a claim. And then there's the question of whether the claim that was presented is a valid claim that starts the deadlines running. So things can get complicated.
Sure. Well, thank you again for that explanation. What are a few of the most common mistakes that individuals make when completing a claim for damages or a government claim form?
One of the ones we see the most often is sending the claim to the wrong person. Government Code Section 915 spells out exactly who receives a claim, and we'll be talking about that later. If the claim doesn't go to one of those people, it doesn't have to be acted on as a claim. It's a very strict requirement. Another common mistake is just a typo. You have a wrong number in an address of where the accident took place, or a wrong digit in the address to which notice has to go. You can have a claim that's not signed. If it's not signed, again, that's important that it be signed. If it isn't, then you may not waive anything by not responding to it. There can be insufficient information in the claim, giving the date, place, and other circumstances of the occurrence. The person presenting the claim may think it's enough information. A court later may think it's enough information. To the district who's receiving it, it may not be enough information to investigate to find out what happened. It omits an address for notices to be sent to. Again, as I mentioned, it has to be a post office box address, not just an email address or a fax number or a Zoom account or something like that. When a claim is presented on behalf of multiple claimants, a common mistake is not identifying all the claimants properly. You can't say claimant John Doe and his family. You have to identify the family members who are making the claim. This is particularly wrongful death and survival claims. The claim form has to identify the survivors of the decedent who are presenting the claim or who, on whose behalf the claim is presented. And if the estate is making a survival claim, in addition to the wrongful death claim, it has to make clear that the estate or an authorized representative of the estate is making that claim. Those are some common mistakes.
One follow-up question I have, Daniel, is so it is okay for multiple claimants to be listed on one claim form? Is that correct?
It is, and we see it most often with wrongful death claimants. We also see it when a family member is injured and a spouse asks for loss of consortium and the children have their own claims. We see that when a child is injured and the parents have their own claims, such as for infliction of emotional distress. We also see that in class actions, and that's a fairly complicated area that I'm not going to get into in this call. That would be the subject of a completely different talk.
Please be certain to tune in to part 2 of this version of the ZISC podcast. I'll be sitting down with Daniel again to discuss the complexities of the government code and the impact it has on claims filings against school districts.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of the CISC podcast and greatly appreciate you listening to our show. Please check the CISC Property and Liability website at cisc.kern.org for a complete listing of podcast topics under the Property and Liability tab. Until next time, stay safe as we continue with the CISC mission of schools helping schools.
Production facilities for the CISC podcast are provided by KETN, a service of the Kern County Superintendent of Schools.